Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review, the Battle of the Midwest. The biggest stage in politics is set with Chicago and Milwaukee selected to host the Democrat and Republican National Convention. Plus, Republicans are reintroducing a series of bills related to unemployment in wake of a ballot referendum last week voters overwhelmingly approved. And looking ahead to 2024, who might take on Senator Tammy Baldwin as she officially announces her reelection campaign? All this and more on Rewind, your week in review for April 14th.
Hi, I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
All right, let's talk about the Midwest showdown that is officially set for the national conventions. We have the Democrats in Chicago, and we have Republicans in Milwaukee. Now, this really kind of just stresses the importance of the Midwest. Now, while Chicago and Illinois is not a technically a battleground state, it definitely has some importance for Democrats, too, because it's typically blue. But I did ask Governor Tony Evers, you know, kind of what do you think about this now that things are set? Let's just first take a listen to him and then kind of talk about the importance of these two cities.
I was advocating for Chicago. I think some of the money will go across the border occasionally because of Wisconsin being so close, but I think it tells a story politically around how important the Midwest is in winning presidential elections, and whether Republican or Democrat, as the Midwest goes, that's how decisions are made.
So this kind of also, we've talked about Republicans too, of how they've been trying to make inroads in Milwaukee for a while now. So that's what they're going to be trying to do. And it's going to be interesting on who's going to be on that stage as well. But for Democrats too, I mean, there's no doubt that it's been a fully, you know, kind of a blue wall, blue state for a very long time. And they're looking to capitalize on that.
So, because you know I'm a dork about politics, this is a rare example of the two parties being right next to each other. In 1972, both parties met in Miami Beach, Florida for their conventions. Since then, the closest they've been was 220 miles away, Boston, New York, 2004, about 90 this time. For Democrats, this is a union city. It's a big deal because Atlanta is maybe part of the future of the Democratic Party, right? Georgia turned blue in the 2020 presidential election. There are trends down there that are good for Democrats. It's also a right-to-work state. Illinois, union town, much different situation. There's kind of a symbolic thing there. And yeah, you know, the blue wall, the question I have is how blue are the bricks anymore?
Right.
Especially after last fall. Now, Wisconsin's still pretty purple, like 3.4 points for Governor Evers is a blowout in some ways. But Michigan, Pennsylvania, deeper shades of blue. So we'll see how big a deal that is. And oh, by the way, I found no correlation between where you have your convention and if you win that state that fall. There may be some coincidences, but it's not been a proven track record. Like, oh, you come to Wisconsin, you're going to win that state that fall.
So. I mean, maybe energize some voters in the area, but no guarantees. It's also, for me, I know it's going to be a shorter drive driving to the conventions. Now, but also speaking of Milwaukee, we also learned this week that we always knew there was going to be Republicans holding their first debate in August, but now we officially know who's going to be hosting it. It's going to be hosted by Fox News, and it will be this summer in August in Milwaukee. And the television company is partnering with former Governor Scott Walker's group, the Young Americas Foundation, and the streaming website Rumble to host the debate. So as you can see here on the slide that we're going to bring up in a little bit, there's still some question marks around some candidates of who could possibly on that stage, but for some that we know, it's going to be former President Donald Trump, Nikki Haley, Perry Johnson, Tim Scott just launched an exploratory committee this week. And then the other three that we know are very likely to enter the race but are still kind of waiting on the sidelines is Ron DeSantis, former VP Mike Pence, and Mike Pompeo.
A couple things to note about this. One, this is Republicans going around the mainstream media. Remember, YouTube is owned by Google. Rumble is this conservative video outlet, so there's that going on. Two, with DeSantis, a little bit of a tangent here, but Mike Gallagher, congressman from Alawes up in the 8th District, is co-hosting a meet and greet for DeSantis on Tuesday in Washington, D.C. with other members of Congress. People tell me he's not endorsing DeSantis. but it's more of a chance to let DeSantis talk to members of Congress and pitch his message as Republicans look for an alternative to Donald Trump. For 2024.
And sticking on our theme of 2024, we also got the official announcement from Senator Tammy Baldwin that she will be running for re-election. Now, she was first elected in 2012, and in her statement that she issued, she said she's running because she's committed to making sure that she works for Wisconsinites and the working people. She also mentioned what's at stake, from families struggling from rising costs to a ban on reproductive freedoms, and she says Wisconsin needs someone who can fight and win. Now, this also comes as we really still don't know who is going to run against her. But we've also talked on the show before, JR, of some of the possibilities. We know a businessman, Eric Hovde, has said after he decided not to run for governor last year that he's going to be considering a U.S. Senate run. So that's a name out there. Mike Gallagher, who you just mentioned. There's some people that want him to run, but he hasn't really committed. Any other names that you're hearing from, JR?
So let's talk to people who are for real right now. So Eric Hovde is for real. He's actually talking to people about running. Scott Mayer, a businessman from Franklin, is for real. He was out, actually talked to him the day that Baldwin announced. He was in Washington, D.C., talking to consultants about a possible run. They are doing things to prepare for a bid for the U.S. Senate, and they are actually real. Then you have this other kind of like these other tiers of candidates. So Mike Gallagher, he is the one Mitch McConnell wants, right? Mitch McConnell is the Senate Minority Leader out in Washington, D.C. They love his profile. He had $3 million in the bank end of 2022, former Marine, young guy, up-and-coming member of Congress. He's got a lot of good attributes they love to see. Gallagher, though, if you talk to anybody around him, they'll tell you that he'd have to have the basically the perfect scenario. What is that? Well, the economy goes to pot and Joe Biden's numbers crater. Like, that changes the scenario. But if we're sitting here right now with Joe Biden low 40s, you know, the economy doing okay, good on some parts, not great on others, there's not really a great avenue to challenge Baldwin. So if that avenue opened, Gallagher get in. He also has lots of time. That money he has stashed away gives him the opportunity to wait, I'll say as long as he wants, but maybe into like spring of next year for pulling a trigger. Then you have these kind of others who, okay, if that dream scenario for Republicans opened up, they might get in. So a source close to Roger Roth this week I talked to said, yeah, he's been approached by it. He's got concerns about the infrastructure of the parties, right? We know Democrats have more money than Republicans right now. But he'd keep an open mind. Kevin Nicholson, can't be counted out, ran for Senate 18, governor in 2022. But again, they have to have that dream scenario open up for Republicans to run. Then you've got, I almost mentioned Sheriff Clark. He said he was basically open to it. That's not really running for Senate. He's just basically getting attention.
He said that on one of his podcasts, correct?
So that's my landscape. And, you know, people are talking about how strong Baldwin is, and she is. I mean, she's a great fundraiser, two-term incumbent. Look at the map nationally. If you're a Republican, you're going to go to Ohio, West Virginia, and Montana right away, right? Those are your top targets. Your next tier, Wisconsin, Nevada, Michigan, Pennsylvania. Well, where does Wisconsin fit into that? Michigan's an open seat, but it went bluer than Wisconsin in 2022. Where do we fit in? And oh, by the way, Nevada, Arizona, who knows what's going to happen there? Mm-hmm. You've got Kyrsten Sinema running as independent. You have both candidates on the left and the right running against her. Like, where will the resources flow in 2024? Are we going to be a top tier for stuff? Don't forget, we had a $200 million campaign for Senate last year. But then again, think about Baldwin this way. In 2018, she won by 11 points, right? So that makes her look like she's such a strong candidate. But she had a 5-to-1 spending advantage over Leah Vukmir. She hasn't had recently a really tough, like, well-funded challenger. In 2012, well, Barack Obama won the state by 7 points. She won by 5, I believe, over Tommy Thompson. So could you find somebody with the resources, the profile, the environment? That is like drawing an inside straight for Republicans. So right, it can happen. But I wouldn't hold your breath right now. Not saying she's going to win no matter what.
Correct.
But
yeah,
she is going to be formidable for a number of reasons in 2024.
And also in 2024, with the Senate so closely divided, just even slight changes could be a mix-up. So if there is a contender that can go toe-to-toe to her, it can be much more important race than what we thought. So, all right. Now let's kind of move on to legislature this week and kind of actions that we saw out of the state capitol. Let's first start with a kind of a series of unemployment bills, many of them that we've seen previously introduced that Governor Tony Evers vetoed. So a lot of these that we're going to talk about are likely doomed for his veto pen, but there are some new ones. So these are the two that have been reintroduced. There were more about a half a dozen bills that received a public hearing this week that range from tying unemployment benefits to the state's unemployment rate to taking away benefits from someone who skips out on a job interviews. Now, like I said, these bills were introduced previously, but they were also introduced nearly after 80% of voters, I believe it was around 78% of voters, approved a ballot referendum that asked voters about welfare. It asked specifically whether able-bodied, childless adults should be required to search for work in order to get unemployment or other benefits like food stamps, etc. Now, they're already have to meet some sort of work search requirements, et cetera. But it was almost in a sense for Republicans to say, hey, look at this evidence here. This is why we should pass it. During the public hearing, Representative John Plummer kind of reintroduced his bill and talked about what was called on quote unquote ghosting, which means you say you're going to accept an offer or you say you're going to show up for an interview, then you don't. Well, if that were to happen, you could lose unemployment benefits. And then on the other side, just listening to Democrats throughout that public hearing that I was listening to, Dems said not really these bills are going to solve the long-term worker shortage problem. They also repeatedly brought up the child care issues, that there are barriers to some people who maybe don't have a car or there's not public transit in their area for them to get to these jobs that some people who want to find work. So let's take a listen from those from Democrats and John Plummer.
In the immediate aftermath of pandemic era closures, Wisconsin saw an increased volume in work searches, with many people looking for new jobs after their closures and layoffs. Along with this uptick in work searches, we unfortunately saw an increase of ghosting, a practice in which an employer will contact a prospective employee for an interview only to have that individual either not reply or not show up for the interview. And businesses are not required to report these, but they will be able to report these under this bill. But in the worst case scenario where you're being challenged for that particular week and in danger of losing your benefits, you can appeal that.
How can we work together to address the child care hurdles that we're hearing, knowing that in rural areas especially we have child care deserts? There's access to transit in some communities. That's a huge issue, as well as affordable housing. There are many people who can't live in the communities that they work. So if their car breaks down or there's no linkage for public transit, good luck getting to work. And for every person that has a story like that, that's another employer and those employees who are at work that's disappointed and stressed. That leads to burnout. And so I hope that the legislature can have a larger conversation. I'm sure there's still work that needs to be done, but if we're talking about barriers to entry for the workforce, we need to focus on the big ones like childcare.
So unemployment in general is likely going to be a theme that we're going to see on the Assembly and Senate floor at some point. We know that they are meeting next week. We did look at the calendar. None of these were on there yet because these still haven't been voted on in committee or whatnot, but that is something we're going to see probably likely down the road.
So I counted five Assembly bills that were on unemployment circulating. There's one on basically with Badger Care Plus requiring Department of Health Services to, if you're not eligible, push you off and start doing like regular checks of eligibility. That is kind of contingent upon what the feds are doing. So remember, with the COVID-19 packages, the feds said you basically are going to need an enhanced matching rate for your programs like this. You can't push people off who once they're on. Now that the emergency is over, we're moving out of the pandemic in that regard, that would open the door to them going off. I think it expires in 2020, maybe around another 6 or 8 months. But anyway, it's basically saying once we have the window to do this, we want to start getting people off the program if they're not eligible. Then there's a bill that would prohibit minimum payments from government to people. Just say, hey, here's minimum monthly payments, salary. Right now, Madison has a volunteer program, or I should say a privately funded program, which are making minimum monthly payments to people, about 146 participants, average salary about $16,000 roughly. I believe almost all of them have kids. Basically give them a monthly minimum, okay? These are all part of this bigger package of the idea of you should have to basically earn your benefits. You shouldn't get anything for free. It's all tied to the referendum that passed, although it didn't get a whole lot of attention. It was about 80% people
voted
for
it. I think
it
was around 78. I just said nearly 80,
yeah.
Correct.
So, but there wasn't a whole lot of a big public push for that. About $500,000 I found that was spent by a group to promote that referendum. But Republicans are going to use that as a jumping off point of, for this whole session of, we want to talk about, because we need issues that are good for us. They have problems with these other issues like abortion and everything else.
Changing
this
the message.
This is an issue that's good for them. And, you know, the people generally believe you should work for what you're getting. You shouldn't be given a free handout, those kinds of things. So watch this plays out. Evers has vetoed most of the stuff before. I don't know that this has changed dramatically for him where it was before. He didn't feel any pressure about it politically last fall, right? Still won.
Right.
So other things overshadow these things. But I'm going to watch for, are we going to see more things like this to try and drive a message of, we need to get people in the workforce. Don't forget, too, we have a pretty high labor participation rate in Wisconsin compared to the rest of the country. It's much lower than it was 20 years ago. What's happened the last 20 years, the boomers are starting to retire. And I don't want to, you know, pick on boomers, but they're retiring earlier than prior generations because mm-hmm. they can. So they're out of the workforce. That is a part of the challenge. Well, by the way, migration would be a big part of helping our job force. Population-wise, we are going down right now.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw the census numbers
yes,
from last week. We have recovered most of what we lost post-pandemic or during the pandemic, but we're not by much. And Milwaukee is still losing people. We're still having issues, and migration might be the key for this, but how do you get the federal government to fix the migration issue?
Yeah, Milwaukee lost about 28,000 people since 2020. And I was looking at those census numbers, so kind of a problem for them. Even I know, remember Mayor Cavalier Johnson, when he was running for mayor, he said he wanted to get up to 1 million residents. So that's going to be a little bit difficult, too, with the violence that's going on right now. Of course, there's a lot of factors than just that, but people are migrating out elsewhere.
Yeah.
Also, with these bills, too, just one other note, too, what previously was introduced, too, was a variety of changes mm-hmm. at DWD, the Department of Workforce Development. Republicans once again kind of nitpick them from during the pandemic. They saw this huge backlog. The bill would also kind of increase call center hours and make various like kind of audits and checks to make sure, kind of like similar to Badger Care, that people are still allowed to be getting these benefits and ensuring that benefits only go to people who lost their jobs and are still searching for work. All right. Also, another Republican bill that got some chatter this week was a gun bill that would require or actually allow some school officials with concealed carry licenses to have weapons in schools. Now, this bill went out for co-sponsorship 2 weeks after a school shooting in Nashville and happened on the same day that there was a mass shooting in Louisville. Now, this was introduced by Representative Scott Allen and Senator Corey Tominski. Sorry for if I mispronounced that. They introduced a bill that would, like I said, allow school administrators to carry. Now, this is similar to other proposals we've seen in the past that Governor Evers vetoed. They would allow basically to have your weapon in your car on school grounds because apparently to some Republicans, they heard from constituents that when they were dropping off their kid, sometimes they've had their weapon on them and they forgot, vice versa. The proposal would also let school districts kind of adopt a policy. So it'd be up to local mm-hmm. control to vote this in. And teachers could waive fees associated to concealed carry to get this. So some Democrats I talked to this just said kind of this was kind of poor taste. They didn't appreciate that this was coming kind of so soon after a school shooting. But we've always, even, you know, from Democrats, you know, once school shootings happen, too, they usually try to have their presser about implementing red flag laws, universal background checks, something Governor Evers and Dems have tried to push for many, many times, but none of them ever reached the legislature, even go through the committee process. So Governor Evers, after I posted this story, within 5 minutes, commented on Twitter and said, absolutely, we are not going to sign this into law.
So remember, he's talked about Republicans want to find issues to talk about that are better for them. So what are they doing poorly right now, suburban voters? This is not necessarily going to help people I talk to. Now, the Germantown School Board had passed a resolution essentially calling for this. This is what the lawmaker said was the inspiration for this bill. Remember, gun-free zones around schools are basically school property in 1,000 feet. There are exceptions under state and federal law. State law, for example, if you are on private property, so if you live next to a school, you can have a gun, right? So that's an exception. Federal law is an exception. If states that allow, states can create an exception for people have concealed carry permits if the permits issue with a background check, I believe, or something like that. We don't have that exception. This would create that and just enable the school boards to allow folks to have it. But again, Evers is not going to sign any bill that changes gun laws to allow a more liberal use or carrying of weapons, period. That's just not where he's going to go. He wants to go toward red flag laws, universal background checks. This is a non-starter for Governor Evers. What's interesting is we haven't seen a whole lot of bills. Well, one, we haven't seen any bills, period, this session so far. It's been very quiet. But there's been not much of an appetite so far from lawmakers to go and really confront Evers with like hot button topics. So these UI bills, unemployment stuff, isn't really like a hot button thing, right? People overwhelmingly kind of back stuff like this. This is going to be interesting. Are we going to see more bills like this session, that really try to create a conflict with Evers or a set up a veto showdown about something like this?
Right. And I'm interested, will it receive a public hearing? Because we've seen what's different this session, and even talking to lawmakers, is that they're kind of tired of sending Governor Evers multiple bills that are bound for a veto pen. Now, unemployment's a little different. There are some new bills in the package. You know, it remains to be seen. But that's kind of the sense that we've got, even from the start of this session, that we don't want to give the governor a new record for vetoes, which he reached last year. Now, this is an interesting bill that is not in bill format yet, but was introduced by Representative David Steffen. I spoke to him this morning, which it basically mirrors a Utah law that would put social media restrictions in place for minors. This comes in lieu of the federal government enacting to ban TikTok on government devices. We know Governor Evers, of course, adopted a state ban as well. So here's kind of the highlights of what the bill would do. Now, once again, it is not in bill format, but he kind of laid out the parameters of what this would do. So it would require parental consent to create a social media account. It would limit advertisers' access to a minor's account. It would block the ability to direct message from individuals who are not pre-approved. That means if you're not friends with that person, they can't send you a DM. And it would also fine social medias that do not comply. The one that really was interesting to me is that it would implement restrictions where you can't even use these apps if you're under the age of 18 between the hours of 10 p.m. and 7 a.m. I know I'm on my phone at 10 a.m. scrolling, looking at Twitter. I mean, other platforms as well. But that is the prime time that they don't want them in the room alone, you know, possibly looking at content that they shouldn't. So the real issue here is, though, reading into the Utah law that was signed into law by their governor, you know, it's expected to face legal challenges. Why? Because it's an enforcement issue. How are you going to enforce this? When I talked to Representative Steffen about this morning, he said the bill is a little bit different because it's solely on social media companies to monitor this. That's what's different from the Utah law. So they would fine them up to about $8,000 a day if they aren't following these rules. But simply asked him, I mean, you can't really prevent this all the time, right? If I'm a 14-year-old, I take my mom's phone and I'm on her social media, you know, they could still get around this. So it's not going to end all be all. But I'm interested, will it get bipartisan support? What does the governor think about it? And he expects the bill to be introduced by the end of next week. So
it's also a parental control issue. Mm-hmm. You're dictating parents when they can allow their kids to be on social media. So right. That's been an interesting debate. Especially Republicans have been saying, we want to empower parents with education and what's going on in their kids' schools.
All right, let's get to stock picks this week. Rising is Don Brewink.
So, former state lawmaker, Democrat from Milton, lost last fall. Now he's got a nice post-loss gig as the railroad commissioner. So, talking to him this week, he had made clear to Governor Evers last fall that, hey, I want to continue to serve publicly, even if it doesn't work out this fall. Because remember, the maps that were drawn by Republicans and approved by the state Supreme Court moved him out of the 46th district where he'd represented since 2017, which is a pretty Democratic district, and into the 33rd swing seat. He lost that race by 247 votes,
yeah,
I think.
Close.
Real close.
Mm-hmm.
He told me he took a substitute teaching job after he lost, because he's an educator.
Yeah, he is.
A longtime teacher. Took a longtime sub job in Verona, I believe, in January, and then he got a call in mid-February, hey, this is open, interested. So now he lands there. He's getting about $94,000 a year. If you know anything about pensions, it's a formula for longtime public officials and public employees. Number of years served, maximum, your top three earning years, and other kind of calculations. So I know he made as a teacher, but this could be a pretty good boost to his pension. And it's a great gig to land post-loss. It's also noteworthy because it's the second lawmaker, former lawmaker, that Evers appointed to a paying
yep.
job. Now, he's put like Dana Walks in the Board of Regents, Sonny Pope Hospital Commission, something like that. But for a paid job, it's a rare thing for Evers to do this. Also worth noting, this is the third former lawmaker I know has become Railroad Commissioner. Jim Doyle appointed Roger Bresky in 2008. Bresky was a Tavern League guy, opposed the smoking ban. Once Doyle made him Railroad Commissioner, another Dem won his seat. The smoking ban passed the next spring. Jeff Plaley had appointed Railroad Commissioner by Scott Walker, kind of a reward maybe for opposing union contracts at the end of the lame duck session in 2010, opened the door to Act 10. So just kind of worth noting.
All right. Mixed this week is the Milwaukee Brewers. You and I grabbed Assembly Speaker Robin Voss after the Rules Committee yesterday, kind of just gauge what is going on. He said he's previously met with Brewers officials, met with his caucus. Kind of what was interesting is that, to me, is that he kind of floated a trailer bill to the state budget, because we know kind of the strategy there, right? He could probably get more Republicans to vote for the deal if it's in the budget, but he doesn't want it in the budget. Also, he kind of floated not using state funds. So it's going to be interesting what this final package looks like.
So it sounds like a parallel to the Bucks deal in some ways, and the phrase cheaper to keep him, which was what Scott Walker kept pushing with the Bucks. What I mean by that is Voss pointed out that if you take the sales tax revenue and the income taxes that athletes pay generated by the whole Brewers thing, you're about $23 million a year. If the Brewers go away, you lose that money. And oh, by the way, taxpayers largely own American Family Field because of how it was constructed years ago. So you'd have a loss of revenue and this, in his words, albatross that we'd have put on taxpayers with no team in it. So how do you address that? He said no public subsidy, state subsidy, beyond that pot of $23 million. He's talking about a local input. What's that going to look like? We don't know yet. And he expects Democratic votes. Now, remember, both houses are reluctant to put bills on the floor unless you have enough votes from the Republican caucuses to pass them.
Right.
So 50 in the Assembly, 17 in the Senate. An exception was the Pfizer Forum bill. That got through 35 Republicans in the Senate, or Assembly, and like 15-ish in the Senate. So you had to have Dem votes to get across the finish line. The question is, okay, they are telling Democrats, you're going to have to help us with this. We're not going to do it alone, which is what happened in the budget. My question is, will that empower Democrats to ask for changes? Like, what might they seek? Labor agreements, for example? Might they push for that? Will Republicans be open to that idea? It'd be fascinating to watch if there's any wiggle room or buy-in from Democrats in this process. And part of it is, there are a dozen Democrats from Milwaukee in the Assembly, three in the Senate. Will they buy in? Because they'll pressure to buy in because it's in their backyard. Two of those Democrats in the Assembly are Democratic Socialists, by the way, not real big on public subsidies for sports teams. But what I'm hearing from Republicans is a little bit, there would be some people are not going to vote for it no matter what. But there's also this sense of, okay, one, I voted for the Pfizer Forum. This is an easier deal because Pfizer Forum was, you know, building a stadium basically for billionaire owners. Mm-hmm. This is maintaining a stadium that we already built with taxpayer money.
Correct.
It's a little bit different sell job, so they're feeling okay about it, but I don't expect 50 votes from Republicans in the Assembly and 17 from Republicans in the Senate. The question is, how many Dems do you need? What do they get in the deal?
And talking to Dems this week, too, they also kind of were in the same lane where after Voss said, you know, Governor Evers' plan is DOA, a lot of Dems weren't even in favor of Governor Evers' plan to begin with. So that will be something interesting. They're looking for other things that are included in this. Like I said, a lot of them said the same thing about Pfizer Forum, but some even had the problems with the Pfizer Forum to begin with. So it will be interesting to see how many Dem votes, like you mentioned, because they're not even a really big fan of what the governor proposed in the first place. All right, and falling this week is a familiar face, Harry Waite. We haven't heard from him in a while.
Yeah, so remember, he's charged with vote fraud for requesting absentee ballots of Robin Voss and Corey Mason, the Racine mayor, without their permission. He had argued that these cards would be thrown out on First Amendment grounds, that he was basically doing a protest, essentially, to prove a flaw in the system. Racine kind of judged it and buy it this week. Basically said, one, you don't meet the test for First Amendment protections, and two, you didn't need to request the ballots of Voss and Mason without their knowledge to prove the vulnerability you pointed out, because you got permission from two other people to do the same thing. Yes, you can criticize people in public, you know, public officials, but you can't use the First Amendment to commit fraud, essentially. Next up for Harry is he's got a hearing, I believe, next Friday in this case. Remember, he faces four counts. The two election fraud ones are misdemeanors. The two felonies are for basically stealing somebody's identity to ask for these ballots. But this judge has not been very tolerant of his claims that he's some kind of like political protester who's doing this for the good of the people. They basically, you committed fraud. There's no protection from that in the First Amendment.
All right, remains to be seen next Friday. Mm-hmm. All right, thanks for joining us this week. I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
We'll see you next week.
This program was brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. the Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.